Ben, I think in the last show, we came up with the dialectic aesthetics versus politics, and we developed that. And then I was thinking later, is it more aesthetics versus technology? Can you, how much is politics and technology intertwined? That's a bigger, that's maybe more important than tech, than politics versus aesthetics. It's more aesthetics versus politics, but politics is more and more embedded with technology. I mean, there is a school of thought that say when they brought in the highway system in Los Angeles, they knocked out the bus system, and some it was Langdon Winner. Langdon Winner did the early articles on Captain Beefheart. He's a professor of autonomous technology or something. I think that's the name of his book, 1979. And he says that what technology gets put in is political, and he used the LA example, which Chinatown kind of goes into, of the dismantling of a good public transportation system into the suburban over traffic highway stuff. So he was making the point that politics needs to look at technology as political, what technologies come in. So how can we do that? Aesthetics versus politics slash technology?
Well, I think when you divide things up like that and then one's amazed that they talk to each other, it's a problem of one's own chopping everything up into these different areas. It seems to me that these are all different ways of looking at the same thing, which is us living as social beings in a society and attempting to survive and to flourish. So when you say, what about technology, as if this is a great third other thing, well, that means you can approach everything and write a history of the world in terms of technology, of the techniques which human beings have evolved to deal with what they wish to deal with. And indeed, as I argued in my book on Frank Zappa, you can base everything on the poodle if you want. If you get really interested in poodles, you find that they are very fine hunting dogs originally. They're not ornamental at all, that they that their particular cut on the poodle was developed to support it in water because you shot a duck in the air and the very strong dog would go out and get your duck back. They were used in war as fighting dogs, and later on they became a lap dog, an ornamental thing. And when you think about the poodle, it's like a parable of civilization, of how we used to be hunter-gatherers and out there really dealing with the beasts, and we've become domesticated and become things which only worry about culture and the ornamental, that process. In other words, what I'm saying is you could take anything, you take aesthetics or politics or technology or indeed the history of poodles, and I deliberately chose it as something which immediately made people wince in academic seminars as something ridiculous that seemed to be making fun of them. But you could say the history of pebbles or the history of air or you could take any of these things that, if you look into them deeply enough, you can find a point of view which can shed light on the whole thing. So I don't see, you know, for me, aesthetics and politics are useful to set against each other. If anybody's too political, I'll throw aesthetics at them and vice versa. But when you throw in the third term, then I'm thinking, well, how many more terms could we throw in? And so I throw the poodle in or anything in. I don't find technology the great leap forward. I've had aesthetics and politics battling in my head. Now we have technology, and this is probably my continuing distrust of your McLuhanite techno-determinism, that somehow it's the printing press or it's the electronic age which explains every change. And I find that quite superficial, because I think these are symptoms of a more underlying thing, which is the mode of production. And I maintain my Marxist base, that it's the mode of production, in other words, the way in which society reproduces itself in general, which is the dominant mode of an era. And that's how you have to understand things, that you don't understand the Middle Ages by saying the quill pen. That was a technology used in the Middle Ages, but really it's extraction of surplus value from serfs who worked on the land. If you use that as your guiding thing, I think you'll come to a better understanding of the Middle Ages than saying the quill pen. So technology is, of course, interesting and can shed light, as anything can. But I don't see throwing it into aesthetics versus politics has any particular insight. Or if it does, what is that insight? Let's get off just talking about generalities. What's missed if you just play off aesthetics against politics? What are you dissatisfied by our last conversation? Why do you want to throw in technology, Bob?
Because technology helped to politicize aesthetics.
Well, do you see, for me, aesthetics...
The commodification of culture.
Well, commodification is an economic idea, isn't it? It's not to do with technology. It's to do with how you treat culture, how you package it up for sale. And for me, aesthetics has always been completely bound up with technologies of perception. That, I mean, let's use vulgar definitions, because that's something to start with, the common definitions. If you talk about aesthetics, it means art. If you talk about art, everybody knows, well, art really starts with the Renaissance. Before that, art was in the service of religion. With the Renaissance, Michelangelo insulting the Pope and so on, art stood up and said, no, the fact that I'm an artist makes me a real person in society. Art began, aesthetics began as an argument. But it's possible to think of that as entirely bound up with the technology of perception, the technology of representation, the technology of finding out how you represent depth on a flat surface, the amazing things which the Renaissance achieved, which in the Middle Ages they were still constructing pictures that look flat, that suddenly this illusion, this ability to create space arrived. Well, that's a technique. So I don't see why aesthetics suddenly discovers technology in the 19th century or something. I don't see why suddenly we stumble across this threshold then. Artists have always worried about technique. I mean, they are specialists in technique.
See, you did it again, Ben. I was going along willing to drop the McLuhan and tackle this, and then you start explaining a bit of the past, and you have no clue what you're talking about. It would be clear what you're talking about if you understood McLuhan. I mean, why technology is technique. Speech is technique. I don't know. The interesting thing is that finding the illusion of depth was parallel to the book page coming in. The printed book page.
Well, all these things
seem to be related.
I mean, all these things that seem to be related and seem to hang together require some deeper explanation. And
let's try to. Okay, what is the deeper explanation?
Well, that's the thing which interests me. I'm interested. The thing that's always puzzled me is why it is that harmony. I'm talking about music.
Yeah.
That the tempered system, the system worked out in the piano, embodied in the piano, that system of keys, a slight lie about how natural sonority works and strings vibrate and echo each other, but that slight lie allowed an incredibly rich arrangement of musical notes, so that you had these different keys and it was very clear whether you were in one or the other, and then all the excitement of modulating from one key to another, which is essentially the history of romantic music from Bach up till Wagner. Why is it that system went into crisis at the same time that every other discipline that had been invented over the 18th and 19th century also went into crisis? What was going on? And I find this social and political explanation, the idea that a new form of society was beginning to arise and there was a battle over what this new society could be, that this is what exploded during the revolutions at the beginning of the 20th century and the First World War. I find that explanation is the one that I cling to. And going back in the past, I find an explanation that I can describe why the printed page and the new forms of representation go together. And it's because of the growth of an independent class in the towns who are not dependent upon the aristocracy or the religious institutions to pursue what they need to do, that freedom, that urban air, that it all goes together. And it's these new arising social groups which need these new techniques. And for me, that kind of description, which I describe as a Marxist way of looking at things, is able to see why these strange connections happened.
Did you say you could see how perspective, Renaissance perspective, and the printed page go together? You said you could see that.
Yeah.
Right. But you can't see how movies, telephones, automobiles, airplanes and radio might have been a factor in the shift in 1900, 1905, 1910. You don't see that, why the sensibilities change? Without the telegraph and the telegraph press, the worker wouldn't have the emotion of multitude that they got, that Marx and Engels wrote in on.
Yes, but...
I'm willing to say, if you can see half of that, that's 50%. Let's look at the other 50%, which is people and how they adjust their lives or create their lives. That's the part you're sliding over to, that 50%. I think you would say that the telegraph is 50% of the story. Maybe not the whole story. It's always up to, you could have radio and all that, and no artist came up with cubism. You know, just nobody thought of it. But individuals do, and that's the individual's uniqueness, or responding to things.
You see, but what I'd credit as an insight rather than a journalistic description of various inventions or the various wonders that human beings have invented, a kind of list, a static list, which it seems to me you're creating, is somebody who points out how wonderful ideas did exist in the past, but the time wasn't ripe for them. That I'm against this idea that the technical innovation can explain anything, because I think the technical innovations are actually knocking around in all sorts of ways at all sorts of times. I mean, for example, what we have now with the mobile phone allowing people to look at pictures of each other existed at the time of television, but the particular social needs at the time didn't reflect that. I mean, they weren't necessary for that. The governments wanted to be economic force which allowed television to arise, and they didn't want everybody communicating with pictures. They wanted to beam out to everybody the entertainment and education that the top people thought was correct. Now, without the social intent behind any invention, you don't get the invention spreading or being developed. It's not simply a matter of the, it's like you're looking at results and turning them into causes. And I find that unsatisfactory if I try and think through what you're saying.
Let me give 2 points. First of all, McLuhan did a lot on the history of music and showing the technical causes of the creation of the emphasis on the piano 300 years ago and all that. You might be interested in reading some of that. He answered some of your questions about harmony and melody and dissonance and all that in technical or media terms. Okay, that's one thing. The second idea about videophone, he wrote in the 70s, they tried to bring the videophone into American culture, but people did not want themselves to be seen. You know, somebody phoned and then they're not dressed properly, didn't want to be seen, because Americans back, the baby boomers and the Depression era generation had a high sense of their visuality and did not want to be seen so invaded. So that's why the videophone, it was there, they checked it out, didn't work. But now you've got a generation, several baby boomers, Generation X and whatever, who have low visual definition in McLuhan's terms. They don't care how they look, and they don't have a sense of visual privacy. And that's why there is a reason why the culture can respond to broadcasting pictures now. People have changed. So there's that factor, not the whole story maybe, but it's certainly a half an answer to what you're raising.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he wrote it. In other words, cultures impose their assumptions on the technology. So cultures use television differently. Television has a general tactile effect, but each culture puts their own sensory ratios to balance that off. Okay, so it's not one way, it's two way. The users impose their assumptions on the media, and the media impose their assumptions back. And there's this dialectic.
It's not the kind of dialectic that I'm interested in, because the analysis is not being reflected by what you're talking about. It's not a true dialectic. You're just saying these two things, have a mutual influence on each other. But both the things you're positing are outside you, the observer. It's still an objective sociology that you're arguing. It's not a dialectical one.
Oh, okay. Then it does include individuals. I said the culture imposed. Then there's individual responses. So let's take your point that that's not a dialectic. What is the dialectic you're referring to?
A dialectic in which the observer and the analyst brings to consciousness their own intent while describing the phenomena they're describing. It's the moment at which the person staring down the microscope at the microbe becomes aware of why they are at that moment staring down a microscope at a microbe, which requires a political and social understanding of what their science consists of. And the problem with the way you look at things is often you leave out your own ability to posit these things, and I think therefore include an uncritical moment of celebration of a capitalist development, which is actually squeezing the world and producing a very dangerous situation of ecological catastrophe, mass starvation, wars, and threats of fascism. But these very real threats seem to evaporate from your utopian march of the technologies when we all have mobile phones and we're all talking to each other and looking at each other, that it doesn't include the critical element. So all these horrors that I'm reading about and things that I'm aware of don't seem to have a place in your analysis.
That's incredible, Ben. We've done 15 and 14 hours. Let's get this straight. I'm not a utopian. When you use the McLuhan's method, you look at the services and disservices, and neither are utopian or dystopian. You just look at how older environments are affected and what the new environments will create. There's no utopia. You can't say that. I'm not utopian.
Okay, but I'm just following what you've said to me so far. Maybe I'm wrong for not remembering the previous 13 hours of 14 hours, sorry, of discussion we've already have and bearing that in my head. I mean, maybe we should inform the listeners that we had a little exchange earlier where you told me you thought you were winning in your McLuhan versus Marx, and maybe this has forced me into a back to basics argument, and maybe we've regressed and we've lost, you know, some of the things that we've found. But I'm still, I'm defending my idea. I'm defending my idea of what real dialectics is, and I'm dissatisfied with this idea that it's a blinding revelation that you can specify various technical inventions at different periods and use them as an explanatory tool, because I think they are symptoms of a time. They're merely the things that you need to start by observing, but they're not actually explanatory. So always talking about them and complaining that the world hasn't recognised that we have telegraph and we have this just sounds to me like the most crass Wired magazine-style boosterism of new technology. I can't see where the critical side is. I mean, what I'm asking is, where are these people that haven't recognised that we have telephones and mobile phones and all the rest of all that boring rubbish that everybody goes on about, and computers? You know, where are they and why are they so wrong and what are they stopping that should be started and what's wrong with them? And, you know, because I often find it's the very people who aren't into all the trendy technology who actually produce the things that give me the most insights. I'm not saying that's because I don't use computers or I don't, you know, I'm sick of the argument, do you or don't you? It's like the whole argument about music got completely stupid in the 70s when the great question was, are you using electricity or not? What really mattered was, are you playing good music? And the technological argument, the one that goes between, are you using a computer or not, becomes completely idiotic. I mean, when Frederick Jameson wrote about Ayatollah Khomeini and the disaster that happened to the Iranian Revolution when they got rid of the Shah, and yet they were unable to go forward to create a socialist society, but went into some kind of Islamic regressive society. His great problem was, Ayatollah Khomeini is putting out his speeches on cassette tape recorders. Is he postmodern or not? Because he was using tape recorders. Well, he was using any mechanism he could, like any politician would. It didn't really matter. I mean, you know, if tape recorders hadn't existed, he'd have given out leaflets. But he got so involved with this argument about, is he postmodern or modern? Is he using this technology or that? That it's a complete diversion from understanding what Ayatollah Khomeini was doing to stop the progressive forces that were unleashed by the fall of the Shah in the Iranian Revolution.
Okay, Ben.
That this technology thing is a red herring. It's a red and a convenient red herring for people
totally
who
agrees with you. He wrote Manipulating Satire. How was his writing satire? He knew that people would start noticing technical causes, and he satirized that and got ahead of it by doing it first. when you say the telegraph did this and that, or the cell phone, that's not what McLuhan's talking about. You would never know that. You have to read McLuhan closely. And it's not until the 70s does he admit that he never explained what the phrase, the medium is a message, meant, because he knew it was so complex. So everybody thought he was talking about new technology. The medium is the past, Ben, and how new technology affects the past. So even though I don't expect you to completely get what I'm saying, and I'm not going to go into explaining it, I want to show you it's a lot different than what you're doing. You are saying the very stuff that McLuhan fought against. He fought against people saying TV will change it, make it a better situation, or that TV even changed anything. Now, this might sound like I'm contradicting all that McLuhan says, but you have to realize I can quote you chapter and verse on this
okay.
stuff.
Okay, all right.
You haven't even got to the point that we are not your image of Wired or McLuhan when I'm
right.
representing,
Good.
The, quote, the deeper
Good.
McLuhan.
But if television did not actually change anything, what were the overhanging ideas which used television and made it happen and, in fact, survived? And I think they are not ideas, but concrete forms of social relations, which include respect for capital, which was not broken in the great ructions of the 20th century. That even the people who owned land, institutions like the papacy, which and the church, say the Church of England, which rely upon owning land, survive and flourish because there is still ground rent paid by the capitalist to the landowner. Going back to the historic agreements of 1848, where the capitalist class and the landed class felt frightened by a new form of social ordering, which is the proletariat, which is still what threatens the vested interests of today. And in 1848, they made an alliance, and that alliance has carried on. And despite all the technological changes and everything, you still have to work for a living. You still have to get money that you have no other means of existence. You have to pay rent to someone who owns the land. Therefore, institutions like the church and the papacy medieval institutions can still flourish because they're getting their cut of the pie. So those are the real facts of interest and money which rule the world we're in, which are continually hidden from people by the kind of blather about whether or not you're using a cell phone.
Okay, 2 points. First of all, remember, Baudrillard became the McLuhanite Baudrillard after 1968 failed. And I don't know when maybe by 75, he started writing about, well, what the situations and the revolutionaries didn't understand is that Gaulle used television very differently and not in an expected way. And so Baudrillard was struck by the technical cause, a technical abortion through television of whatever students and people thought they were doing in 68. So he gets up and goes on about technology, and he ends up being a blatant McLuhanite, not Marshall McLuhan, but a McLuhanite. He makes a postmodern mistake. He gets stuck in looking at the technological
which
reasons.
Is possible okay. to do. I mean, when you've been defeated and your great ideas for changing everything are defeated, you can turn around and say, well, look, we didn't look at how clever the other side is. The problem with that process of thought is that you get so involved with how clever the other side and explaining it that actually you become a member of the other side because you find it so fascinating and clever the way they did it. You know, you want to be where cleverness is. And instead of supporting some kind of cleverness for your own side, you end up celebrating them. And that's where
that's
I think
right.
Baudrillard got to. And there's that.
That's right. He became what he beheld. Now, back to your point about the Vatican in 1848. Why do you think that people do not take that fact as a revolutionary foundation? Why are the medieval institutions still happening?
Well, because I think the bourgeoisie, frightened of the new class it had created, of people who had no capital and only always had to work for a living and therefore had no reason to believe in the hierarchies of the past. They were frightened of this new class, and so they formed an alliance with the old class, the landowners, and made an agreement. There's a thing called ground rent, so you'll still be getting your money because your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather actually hit someone on the head to get the land, so that's a right, and you should have it, and you know you own by force this piece of land, and if people live on there, they've got to give you a cut of whatever they earn. They made that agreement. And after that, it meant that a medieval institution could flourish within the new system. And also because it could supply all kinds of ideological stuff, which could make people frightened of the idea of the proletarian class, of people without property taking over, which went under the name of communism.
Why aren't the workers, the proletariat, over the last 25 years recognizing that and doing a revolution?
Well, they are. They're attempting to recognize it, and this is what the big...
They're attempting to recognize it.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
How are they doing that?
Well, I mean, our task as revolutionaries is not to replace the struggles of ordinary people with, some slogans that we dream up. It's to understand what the tensions and conflicts of our time are and bring understanding as to what's actually going on. So I think the way to understand...
Okay, what is actually going on from your point of view is the same old story for 500 years or something.
Yeah, I think we've been... we're pretty stuck. I don't think...
We're pretty stuck. That's an interesting statement.
Yeah,
we're pretty stuck. Okay,
We are stuck because we haven't got rid of the yoke of capital. And I think the idea that the task of intellectuals is to provide intellectual novelties that can give people some kind of, this is a new system you've given me, is actually modelling theory and truth on the commodity form. You know, I need a new dress this year. I need a new cell phone. I need, something new. So I don't find the postmodern accusation that's thrown at fundamentalist Marxists like me that, you're saying the same old thing. It doesn't make me worried. I say, well, I'm saying the same old thing because I'm afraid the same old thing is carrying on. I haven't noticed that people who've inherited capital have been dispossessed. It seems to me that the people who've inherited that capital are carrying on owning it, and that system is perpetuating itself and crushing out all the things that I really love, which have appeared and revolted against it over the past. And I suppose I see my function as somebody who ferrets out these revolts and these rebellions and these ideas and keeps them alive at the current time.
Yeah, so Trotsky today, and I like your show, Out to Lunch, but Trotsky today would be on playing old R&B or whatever he liked from the past and reading text of situation, have his daughter on there babbling with him and doing kitchen symphonies. He would be doing that? Now, you have the right to say no, he wouldn't. But,
Trotsky is a unique formation. You know, everything is specific in history. I don't believe that there are repetitions in that sense, and we can't reproduce the particular congruences which produced a revolutionary like Trotsky, who's both fully educated in the avant-garde Parisian world of letters and yet totally informed about workers' struggle in his own and, in fact, internationally, and is influenced by Marxism at that date. I mean, to try and reproduce that would be absolutely crazy, and I don't think that I'm doing everything on my own. I mean, I know Andrew Bergin, who appears on the radio talking about the current events in Afghanistan, or who's part of the Stop the War coalition and allows that to carry on. And I wouldn't be out without his political focus and his skills and his knowledge of being able to talk to the media about current policy. I don't say that my radio show can sort of wipe out everything else and replace it or anything like that. I see myself as working in conjunction with other people, and I don't see why this megalomania has to overcome us. But I would say that playing R&B, for example, what I'm insisting on playing R&B is it was part of a civil rights struggle and part of a momentous change in American and international relations. And that merely treating it as the invention of a fantastic new way of making money, which is what the Michael Jackson strand of that culture has done, is to obliterate why it makes you feel as you feel when you feel it. So for me, the aesthetics and politics are very bound up, and with the technology of what listening to a recorded voice is, because for me to articulate an aesthetic response, I have to explain it in political terms, that the power of that music can only be explained by understanding it as an expression of a huge struggle by a lot of people to change things fundamentally in the United States. That's what we're hearing. Now, that's creamed off by people in its thrill element and the attempt to turn it into something which is merely about stars and money-making, and they distort it. And so I play that music as a reply to that, encasing it in arguments and interviews with people and poetry, which is usually not put with it at all, but which I think relates to it because all of them are revolutionary.
So,
and I think that's a better method of insisting on our revolution than simply sitting there with a McLuhanite structure about different epochs and different technologies and crowing that no one gets it, which is, seems to me, your contribution. I want to know what your particular contribution to the revolution is, Bob. I mean, you keep saying, well, it's not doing the wrong McLuhanite. It's, you know, it's not McLuhanite, it's the real Marshall McLuhan. But what has this confused Roman Catholic really got to contribute?
Confused, meaning McLuhan.
Mm.
Well, I don't use just McLuhan. See, I'm a quadriphenic, and also I work with a bunch of people. I actually are the wealthiest and most powerful people in the world, and we actually are bringing in cold fusion and all that stuff. So that's one part of my revolution. But I wouldn't limit my activities to just that. I'm here in other realms of media and talking to you because I don't stay in one position, or I'm not just doing one thing. I got four bodies. So my chemical body is working with the secret team, but my TV body and chip body is not. So I don't use any McLuhan in my talk. When I'm on cash flow as Bob Neverett, I point out how McLuhan's obsolete. Okay, so you're going to get different opinions from me in different media.
Okay,
Other media, I talk LaRouche. I might talk mystical stuff with my medium ion. So I'm uncategorizable, you know, and I could be considered a total social psychopath and schizophrenia. I'm quadriphenic.
Well, you could be categorizable simply as a media opportunist.
That
includes all these activities, doesn't it?
I would say that I'm using McLuhan because that's something that can bounce off Marx. And Zappa's in between, that's convenient for us to begin. I mean, listening to the old shows again, I see that we have something in common and you celebrate that, so that's good.
Mm.
But I'm not letting it get in the way of dealing with the present. And I'm trying to, in this show, say, what do we say or what are we doing and who are our allies? Because if I think back of your different shows, you're basically, not our shows, but many shows you've done personally in your books, you are sort of by yourself and one-man crusade, which makes me think that you think that your revolution is the most powerful. But I don't, you probably wouldn't say that, but sometimes you say it. I recognize that you would slip and slide on different points, but what are we to do? But right now, where China's going to dump the dollar, that's good, eh? Or is that bad? Or is that indifferent to you? It's still within the money system. And how do you tell your neighbor this?
Well, pretty much, yeah. I think that's within the money system. And I'm not... people of my class level can influence. Therefore, worrying about their problems is sort of like not what I need to do.
Right. So you're working in other areas that aren't subject to that, even though everybody has to go to work and all that. There's the paradox. You're dealing with complaining about getting, and that's a key point for you, is that you got to get up and go to work. That's, you don't like that, and you would like to get out of that.
Well, no, I'm very aware that there are people who refuse to get up and work, and they become isolated, psychotic, but they also have the time to develop ideas, and therefore I have quite a lot of time for your dropout bohemia and the insights which they may or may not come up with. And it seems to me that the task of a revolutionary analysis is to learn from all sections of the population in their battles with capitalism. And these
that's what I do. Here I am working with the secret team, and at the same time I'm in touch with whatever this world is that's not involved with my secret team, right? So I'm doing what you're doing.
Yeah, and I don't think it's correct, if you're a revolutionary, to chauvinistically support merely one class section and its particular battles. You have to understand all the different people and their complaints. And the power of Marxism for me is because of it, it managed to combine aesthetics and politics in the way that these two things are usually articulated separately, so that people think there's labour politics on the one hand and trade unions and that kind of activity, and then there's the artists over there, and really they have nothing in common. Whereas it seems to me, if you think through the problems that either of them face, if you think through them properly, you come to analysis which says that both criticisms are required. And in other words, you need both an objective criticism, which is talking about social injustice, and a subjective one, which is talking about how you feel, the artistic side, both of them at the same time. And in fact, the division between them is unrevolutionary thinking. Revolutionary thinking always manages to combine them.
It seems that, Ben, that you're unique in the Socialist Workers' Party, whatever it's called over there. You come up, I don't know, you're like a mosquito at the party. It keeps bugging people, and they're trying to get people organized and have some kind of union power or something. And you come in and say, no, you guys should be listening to Frank Zappa. We need to bring in aesthetics. It's almost like you've targeted you're an eccentric in relation to an ongoing institution, the Labour Party there. And I agree, your point is right. But what is any, if they start shooting at each other in a couple of weeks, they're not going to be worrying about whether they're listening to Zappa. And what would you do in that situation?
Well, it depends on whether I'm required or whether I could do anything. I mean, I've certainly thrown myself into various confrontational and difficult situations in the past because of politics, and I'll probably do that again. I mean, it depends on the weight you can pull and on what you can contribute. My particular contribution is that a whole lot of left thinking about culture needed to be revised in the wake of the 60s, really, that I didn't think it had been completely understood.
Okay, what was it that wasn't understood? You probably said this in other shows, but let's say, what is it that was not understood that you felt needed to be corrected or illuminated?
That black American music and its use of the modern technologies of recording had in fact produced a revolution. And this was totally understood by the counterculture in the 60s, all the way up until 68. After that defeat, suddenly this perception vanished from the world.
Right.
The counterculture no longer exists. So I'm trying to remember the unity of the counterculture and maintain it within an area where, if you try and maintain it, you're accused of simply going back to the past. Whereas I think the past and ideas work by leapfrogging each other. That you could have accused the progressive people in the Renaissance of merely wanting to revive the classical age. And I think that someone who thinks about what the 60s could have meant or what the 1920s could have meant is actually carrying something forward to the future, which has been backpedaled by the uses made of that culture by the current people who are visible in the global marketplace.
So you talk about the Black Revolution using modern recording technology. There's a little bit of technology. There's something there. That's a factor. Could the technologies that came after the 60s made it irrelevant or sidestepped or displaced the use of technology by the African American in the 60s? The new technology made a different kind of
music? The way that a lot of new technology has been promoted to me has been totally about the power of editing after the event. It's all been to do with the fact that you can manipulate and control what's already been done in order to take out the bad things, to improve or edit and so I still think that the great breakthrough is the document of an actual expression at a particular time. I still think that that is the critical power, and that most of what's happened with technology, I mean, what I'm saying is that I don't think, for example, recording has really improved much since electronic recording. I think electronic recording is a breakthrough on top of scratchy 78s, which don't seem to have that immediacy. But once you've got a Sun Records type recording of a rock band, it seems to me that all the technology that's developed since then have been about postponing decisions, controlling, managing sound, and not about actually bringing it home to your heart. And therefore, without being I mean, I love what dub does, and I love all kinds of uses of delay and things that you can do, but I think a lot of the things that people have argued to me as being this brand new world of technology, I've looked at it and said, yeah, but these are technologies of the other side. This is about managing sound. This isn't actually about putting me in touch with the people I want to be in touch with. Because technology, you know, can be used by them or by us. It's the them or us I'm interested in defining, not merely is it new technology. The first question I ask of a new technology is who's using it and for what purposes.
Yeah, that's the political point.
Mm.
There's where technology and politics interpenetrate.
Mm.
We got you. That's what we began with. So you, what are you going to say to that? Or you'll find a way to wiggle out of this?
I don't feel I'm stuck on a pin. I'm not wiggling. I'm not wiggling. You know, I'm trying to work out what you're saying and what's true and what I'm thinking. You know, I'm not wiggling around. I have no position to defend.
You have no position. Yeah. And you claim that the POMOs have no position. And you don't like that position of no position that they have.
Well, that's just rhetoric. It's the oldest sophistry there is. Well, you know, I have no position.
And you just used it. You just used it, right?
No, I said I'm not wiggling. You accuse me of wiggling as if I'm uncomfortable in the position I'm in. I'm not uncomfortable with the position I'm in. I think it's the profound understanding. I feel very comfortable in it because I think it's deep. I think understanding things in that way means you're not hooked up with all kinds of idiocies which people have got involved with, which they've later apologized for. And suddenly realize they were cyber boosters for a time, and then they come around and apologize and say, well, actually, after credit crunch, I realized that it was all the result of believing that if you went and talked to some millionaires and said we could have a dot-com company, but I realized that actually profits have to come from exploiting labor, you know, and if you don't do that, then there aren't the profits, and so we can speculate about the profits and lie to each other up to a certain amount, but then it all collapses, the bubble bursts. Which is very old news. I mean, you know, South Sea bubble, it goes back, you know, since the beginning of capitalism, and we've been through a lot of bubbles lately. And so all those people who are blowing bubbles, to me, are popping all over the place and, you know, they're coming back to understanding the world as it actually is. So I don't feel I'm wriggling around. I feel like...
I meant wriggling on that point. That I've shown you that technology is political.
Absolutely.
You said it.
Yeah, I agree. I've now got round to the point, because I've talked to you about music that I care about, that where I've explained to you the connections between aesthetics and politics and technology, whereas I could explain to you because I've examined something I think about, and it's only by looking at the actual material that these ideas can be connected. That if you try and talk about ologies and different disciplines and the need, you know, you have these lists, you know, you can have aesthetics and politics and technology, but what about sexuality? What about food? You know, I mean, you can always throw in something that you should cover. That in the abstract, those things are impossible to sort through. And it's only by looking at a real situation that you can begin to articulate it. So just in reflecting on what black music contributed to the 60s, I hope I explained to you where I think technology fits in.
So you have said in previous shows that you get depressed looking at the general media landscape. How long will you put up with your depression?
I think it's a matter of... building what we're doing and trying to get other people involved with how we're talking. I can't see any other way through it. I don't want to lose my aversion because I think it's creative. I think a repulsion towards what's going on around you is one of the creative moments. I mean, you talked about Iris earlier and making fun of me for trying to be a Trotsky at the same time as talking to my four-year-old, but I find
in public
and well, if you read Trotsky, you'll find say in his late notebooks his observations about everyday life and his wife and his dog and how people around him, that it would be a typical Trotsky remark. When he's writing like this, he's very similar to Walter Benjamin, another writer who paid attention to his immediate surroundings in a dialectical and historical manner, that when the four-year-old, you realize that the four-year-old is always denying every statement you make to her, and that that denial is what's allowing her to think independently, that independent moment is actually the dialectical moment of a real engagement with you. It's not simply denying everything you're saying, that the very denial has in it the ability to actually nail what you're saying and then say something else. And this is why my four-year-old keeps saying no. That's my way of understanding it. Now, what am I doing there? I'm combining a dialectical observation, and dialectics has a history and a politics, but with a personal observation with a child, so it's educational, one needs to do all these things. That's real thinking. And I'll defend this way of thinking. And I think Trotsky and Walter Benjamin are the thinkers who think like that, and they undercut a lot of the pomposity of people who build systems on the left and on the right, which don't have that intimacy and humility. Gosh, that's a frightening noise.
Yeah,
that sounded like, was that a military aircraft going overhead? Are they off to bomb Afghanistan or something?
Yeah, that's my secret team making a move.
All right. Right. Are they coming to obliterate me for my hubris
you.
There?
You guys distracted while we move into some other areas.
So. Right. Okay.
So now what you just said about mixing and using, definitely that's what McLuhan called the encyclopedic tradition, and he was all for that. He called it rhetorical grammarian tradition, and he felt Joyce did that, and he did it, and I'm doing it. Now, you say you bring people to an under... Hopefully the guys woke up to the Wired hoax, and they say, now I understand, Ben. Then people say, well, what do we do now? You don't tell them what to do. But I've been told, just listening to some stuff today, that a lot of the kids in the United States are getting into Ayn Rand and taking responsibility for yourselves. What is your critique of that?
Well, I went and read some... I call it Ayn, because that's how it's written. Do you pronounce it Iron?
Well, the American I was listening to said Ayn.
Ayn Rand. I did get interested in her when I was sort of pursuing an interest in fantasy and pornography and its relationship to politics. So I tried reading some of her books, and what I found was a incredibly simplistic underwriting of a certain moment during adolescence, which is when you react against your parents and teachers and you discover that you're a self. And kids usually go into something in England, although they don't really know what it is, called existentialism. And it's kind of a religion without religion. It believes in yourself and the importance of yourself. You're not quite sure why. It's full of kind of mystical leanings. And you have an existential phase. You go and read Camus, and you worry about shooting an Arab on the seashore, and you maybe read a little bit of Jean-Paul Sartre. Ayn Rand seemed to me like a fairly crass commercialization of that idea into sort of fantasy novels where people discover I, and they've never been allowed to think I before, and always before it had to be we. And I'd say that the moment of discovering that you're an individual is a necessary moment in the development of anybody. That's part of growing up and part of rejection and saying no. You know, that, I mean, little Iris seems to have got to it already at 4 years old. I hope she's not going to start reading Ayn Rand, though. I hope she'll read something a little bit better, like John Norman. It seems to me that she's a particularly... you know, reading the novels, a particularly crass and commercial and conventional way of putting that argument, that because it's a representative novel, it actually includes all sorts of assumptions about people and genders, which are really regressive and kind of laughable. And I'd hope that young people getting into that would rather quickly see through that and realise that if they're really interested in I, they should read some Samuel Beckett. who writes completely about that problem, but actually takes the writing into that problem so that it kind of explodes itself and turns out as the most amazing comedy you've ever read, and makes fun of it. So it's that seriousness in Ayn Rand. I mean, just does need the belly laugh, which I think Beckett and Zappa do provide, because I think they're very powerful anti-fascist satirists. And I think Ayn Rand is still caught within a fascist mentality, which is pretty hilarious when you when you see it.
Yes. So I was listening to this guy interview one of the main propagandists for Ayn Rand now, and he was celebrating the young people are getting into it. But Ben would tell him, well, that's natural for young people. And then Ben was saying, oh, then the guy was saying this is the next generation, and they're going to take over, and they've got this new understanding, and they're going to dismantle government because it's doesn't support self-responsibility and all that stuff. And then Ben would come along and say, well, wait a minute. They're going to take over, and they're not going to be anything new. They're still within this 500-year problem of capital.
Well, no, Bob, don't translate my arguments like that. I was talking to you as a sophisticated, fairly aged literary critic about why I didn't like Ayn Rand. These aren't the things that I'd say to a, you know, to the face of somebody who just read it. I'd say, come on, read me the paragraph that you like, and let's talk about it. I mean, I would have some respect for what they just read. I'm not going to patronize them in the way that I was talking just then. I was talking to you, I hope.
Yes, no, you were. Now, Here, the thing is that they would read the article, and you would talk intelligently with them and snap, but eventually you would have to say what you tell me. Hey, we've been stuck in capitalism, and this new generation may be individualist versions of capitalists, but still capital. Mm. That would be your final answer to the person, right?
Well, I think
you have to challenge.
You know, this basic argument was answered by Karl Marx when he wrote The German Ideology, which was a criticism of the self and its ego by a writer whose name I can't remember, and he took on this the ultra-individualistic argument, and his argument was the socialist one, that if you really want to understand what an individual is, you have to understand the society they came from, because all societies propose, all talk of individuals presupposes a society that could have produced them. That's the fundamental socialist argument, and it's the argument which actually allows you to find out how things work and where things come from, and that positing everything as the individual ends up in nihilism, because you sit trying to understand yourself on your own, and of course you find nothing there, because nothing's really happening in there.
Trying to figure out how to get you out of that trap. Let's see. I'm going to come at it from another angle. If you started talking on the street, as you do on your show, you're in your own poetry, it's quite scrambled and surrealistic or whatever, there's no linear prose there, you break it up on the show, but would you start talking like that if you were asked to speak at the Labour Party convention? Would you just do that? In their response to the evaporation of their money.
No, I'd learn from Trotsky and I try to learn from Trotsky and do straight prose, but at the end of every paragraph I would allow the poetics that I'd learned would allow me to make a sentence that would be extraordinarily penetrative, and for that you do need to understand poetry. That was Trotsky's particular solution to that problem. I don't believe in going and confronting people expecting to hear political ideas with what they'll consider as gobbledygook. I hate that kind of insulting practice. I think it insults both abstract poetry, which has its place and needs to be done, and the politics. It's a matter of being sensitive to the particular situation. And I think revolutionary ideas said as prose have a poetic effect because they disrupt the situations they're in. Because nearly always you're in situations where you shouldn't say things like that. So I don't think there's any worry about, about needing to inject aesthetics into politics in that way. It seems to me really good revolutionary politics have a disruptive and creative effect on audiences anyway. At least that's how I've listened to Tony Cliff over the years when he was alive.
Right. So what's happening? What are you going to do tomorrow to foment the struggle? Is it going to remain within Ben's world of preserving, like a Noah's Ark, the great cultural moments, and spit it back at the land, the desert that we're in today, which I don't think you'd feel we're in a desert. You enjoy your media consumption that you choose, right? You're having a good time.
I'm not sure I am enjoying the media consumption that I choose. I don't feel I choose it. I think it's necessary.
That's a good thought. Let's hold that thought. Let's try to stay on that. You're not sure. Can you go into why or what the symptoms of that are? Or how is that manifested?
Because the only thing that I'm really interested in is a creative moment that is collective and original, and trying to create situations in which that moment can exist requires organization and contacts and the special moments that one works towards. The average, I don't consume in that way. I mean, I'm not looking for articles of consumption. I've learned my music, you know. It's confusing. Learning and consuming seem like the same thing. I think a lot of young people seem to be consuming a lot, but actually what they're doing is learning, which is why I think it's absolutely fine if they download it all and don't pay anyone a penny, because they need that education.
Right, so you...
Whereas when you talk about consuming, it sounds like you're having to pay somebody. And Bob, right. We are coming right towards the end, so you have to wrap it up in 15 seconds, I'm afraid.
Well, praise me, and Ben will be continue to be analyzed next week.
Bye, Bob. That was the end of number 15.
Well, we